Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Edgar Lujano, producer for the show and your host, at least for the next 30 minutes, I think. We'll see. Today's guest, we have Joe Heschmeyer. We're talking about the early church. So if you have a question about the early church, anything, at least about the first 200 years, because I know Joe really specializes on those first 200 years, give us a call, 888-318-7884. That's 888-31-TRUTH. Ask your question to Joe. Joe, it's cool to be on here with you. How's it going? How's your online debates
going? It's
going
great. I want to give a shout out to you because you're covering for Cy. He can't be expected to work a full 2 hours a day, so he'll start from home half an hour from now.
Look,
just want to.
He's got some comfy chairs. He just got some comfy chairs in his office. Usually we had to really pull him out of his office from his deep nap in order to get him to do the show, but. Today he just decided to work from home, so we can't
sometimes
wake him up.
Sometimes he's more pulled out of the nap than others, apparently, So.
Yeah, well, it is what it is. Actually, he's out getting, I think he's out, I could say, a new car. So he's at the dealing
look,
with those.
Look, working 90 minutes a day and getting a new car. This is not getting better. I'm just saying, I hope we can have a lot of people call in to just talk about Cy living high on the hog. You don't have to tell him I primed you for it. He can be surprised. We'll see if he listened to the first part of the show.
I asked him to take pictures of the dealership because I told him I've never been inside of a Lamborghini dealership. So make sure you get those nice pictures because it's probably the most I'll ever get to see of it. So
exactly.
It pays good to work 2 hours or, in this case, 90 minutes.
I hope people know the Lambo part is a joke. Very little of the rest is. it kind of is.
All right. Well, if you got a question for Joe, 888-318-7884. Joe, I got to say, I absolutely love your book. This is one of my favorites that we've printed here at Catholic Answers. Now, you've gone through quite a few different things within your book. You cover baptism. You cover, the hierarchy of the church. One of the things that whenever I've had conversations with Protestants, that they tend to bring up, those that don't believe in a hierarchy, is they say that the early church actually never taught or never believed in an apostolic succession. So my question to you is, where's the evidence in the early church that we have an apostolic succession?
Yeah, so you see the importance of having some kind of succession in the New Testament itself. You can see that in Acts 1 when they choose a replacement for Judas as an apostle with Matthias. You also see it in places like 2 Timothy 2, verses 1 to 2. St. Paul says to Timothy, "You then, my son, being strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus, and what you have heard from me before many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." So think about the kind of generations there. You have Paul, who is teaching Timothy, who is teaching faithful men, who are then going to be able to teach others also. So there's really four kind of generations laid out right there in terms of teachers and students. It's a very clear process. We want to make sure that Christianity doesn't die out just one generation. And the way we do that is a kind of succession of teachers and students. Well, closely tied to this is this idea of a succession of bishops as leaders. Now, we find this extremely early on. Again, I would argue you find this really with the replacement of Judas with Matthias. But you can also find in Hegesippus. Now, Hegesippus is not a name ordinary people know, but he's one of the earliest Christian writers we have outside of the New Testament. He lives from about 110 to 180, so he's a little bit after the time of the apostles, but really not much. And in the mid-100s, somewhere between 157 and 168, he talks about going to Rome, and he says, "On my arrival at Rome, I drew up a list of the succession of bishops down to Anicetus, whose deacon was Eleutherius. To Anicetus succeeded Soter, and after him came Eleutherius." So we have a pretty decent timeline for, he is writing a little bit after the 157 to 168 period, but he's saying he went to Rome during that period, between 157 and 168, and he was able to trace every bishop of Rome from the time of the apostles down to Anicetus. And we also know that this wasn't just something unique to the Church of Rome. Now, as we're going to see, it's something special to the Church of Rome, that there's a special primacy Rome has. But He's also really clear, but in the case of every succession and in every city, the state of affairs is in accordance with the teaching of the law and of the prophets and of the Lord. In other words, one of the kind of guardrails for orthodoxy in the very early days of the church, like the 100s, was, okay, well, we know what the apostles taught. Is the new bishop teaching the same thing as the last bishop? And did he teach the same thing as the bishop before him back to the time of the apostles? So that's one of the things that's going on. Then you jump forward slightly, but only slightly, to 180. And Irenaeus has a famous passage in Book 3, Chapter 3 of Against Heresies, in which he talks about how one of the ways of defeating Gnosticism is to show that this isn't in keeping with historic Christianity. And to contrast scripture and tradition, which are the two things he wields against Gnosticism, he shows that you can prove orthodoxy by looking at what he calls the, quote, tradition derived from the apostles of the very great, the very ancient and universally known church, founded and organized at Rome by the two most glorious apostles, Peter and Paul. And then he lists, after this, every bishop from the time of Peter and Paul down to his own day in 180. And he explains why Rome, like, why is it? Is it just a coincidence that these two writers in the 100s talk about the bishops of Rome specifically? Not according to Irenaeus. He says, for it is a matter of necessity that every church should agree with this church on account of its preeminent authority. So 180, this is the first writing we have that explicitly lays out that the Gospels are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And it's the second writing that we have that lays out the succession of bishops of Rome. So apostolic succession can be traced in early Christianity as far back as the four Gospels. That's how early we find it. And so you can't just take the one and leave the other, I would suggest. These are things that the early Christians clearly believed in. But even more than that, Tertullian, slightly after this, about the year 200, talks about the important role that this played in fighting against early heresies. Because you have heretics starting to pop up and preaching these false doctrines. And his point is that the founders of all these heresies lived long after the apostles. And in his words, persons are still living who remember them, their own actual disciples and successors, who cannot therefore deny the lateness of their date. In other words, if I can point to who founded your religion or your denomination, and it isn't Jesus Christ, well, we've disproved the thing, because the true church can be traced all the way back to the apostles and to Christ. And if we can trace yours back to some heretic instead, like Marcion or whomever, that proves that you're not the real deal. I'm going to quote one last thing from Tertullian. He says, but if there be any, he means heresies here, which are bold enough to plant themselves in the midst of the apostolic age. Like, if you're going to tell me that your form of Christianity really goes back 2,000 years, he says, let them produce the original records of their churches. Let them unfold the role of their bishops, running down in due succession from the beginning in such a manner that the first bishop of theirs shall be able to be able to show for his ordainer and predecessor some one of the apostles or of apostolic men. In other words, he points to the fact that, okay, if you're going to claim, oh yeah, for 2,000 years, the true Christians were all like Baptists, or, you know, they were all Marcionites, or they were all whatever, show me your 2,000-year history, because we can show you our 2,000-year history. We can show you a chronology of every bishop of Rome attested to. We can show you these faithful saints from every century in the history of the church. So if you're going to tell me that this is what Christians have always believed, then show it. And if you're going to tell me you believe a form of Christianity that wasn't what Christians always believed, that sounds like what the apostles call a heresy, that you've come along and preached a different gospel than what we've always believed.
Well, there you have it. All right. If you ever have any doubts about apostolic succession, Joe just crushed your heart, and now you must convert to Catholicism. All right. With that, when we come back, Sai is actually in the studio. That's how fast the Lamborghini is. He drove all the way from North County to here. That's, man, if only I could work.
He was so livid that we were making fun of him. He had to get here quick.
All right. When we come back, you'll have Sai Kellett and Joe Heschmeyer right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment. St. Carlo Acutis shared a dream in which Sister Lucia appeared to him, saying the first Saturday devotion could change the destiny of the world. The Blue Army of Our Lady of Fatima invites you to practice this devotion. Join a First Saturday virtual pilgrimage beginning December 6th. Experience spiritual meditations while traveling virtually through Portugal and Spain to 12 sacred sites tied to the Fatima story. Track your journey with a passport and stamps. Visit BlueArmy.com and select First Saturday Pilgrimage to learn more. Sponsored by Our Lady's Blue Army.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit MysticMonkCoffee.com. That's MysticMonkCoffee.com.
Are you ready to spread your wings? Wings is the weekly newsletter that's packed with exclusive news, program information, features, and updates of all that's going on at the Global Catholic Network. To sign up, go to EWTN.com, click subscribe, enter your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. Get your wings today. It's the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, filling in for Edgar Lujano. We're not getting along anymore, Edgar and I. I had to throw him out of the studio. What's he talking about? First of all, I never nap in my office. Never. If I'm going to nap, I nap in Darren's office, so people think it's Darren. I just turn my back, and people think Darren's napping in there. And then Lamborghini, really? Seriously? You remember, Joe, you remember we were on the air a couple weeks ago when I told you that my car caught on fire on the freeway? Remember that?
We had that conversation. I actually know you say that.
So
you were going so fast in your Lambo, it literally caught on fire.
That was a 2012 car, and I upgraded today to a 2013 car.
Sai had the Model S before the more famous cousin came out.
None of these cars, no. Well, why are you guys giving me a hard time? Why are you writing Ferrari on the sheet and all this? Stop it. It's just a regular poor man's car. But you know what? Nothing ever goes the way you think it's going to go when you're at the car dealer. So I was late. I apologize for that, Joe.
That's all right.
I took a lot of abuse, though. I was in listening to the...
Yeah, we got our full money's worth out of your trials and tribulations.
I know. You're talking about how I work 90 minutes a day.
Sometimes
it was rude. I was in my new old car listening, and you come in extremely clearly on a Lamborghini radio. All right, let's go back to the phones. All right, because I don't like Joe, I don't like Edgar, I don't like any. I like Darren. That's the only person I like.
Darren's hard not to like.
Luke, I haven't developed any feelings about you, Luke. Luke looked hurt that I left him out of that. I just haven't had time to develop feelings yet, Luke. I will.
I agreed with Luke on something on a Teams chat, and he printed it out and posted it. So Luke desperately needs approval.
He's a big fan of yours, Joe. Luke, you're the greatest. You're the greatest ever. The number here is 888-318-7884. Please don't be nice to Edgar when he picks up the phone. Do not be nice to him today. 888-318-7884. Want to talk about the early church with the guy who literally wrote the book on the early church, Joe Heschmeyer? 888-318-7884. You want to go to the phones now?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go to the phones.
All right, I'm just going to sit here and make angry faces at Edgar while you answer a question. Kurt in Redondo Beach, California, watching on YouTube. Welcome, Kurt. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, how you doing today?
Not that good. I don't know if you've heard the show at all. I'm having a terrible day, but... How are you doing, Kurt?
We're being mean to Cy, but it's good.
Sorry. I've been listening over the phone and couldn't hear much of it. Sorry.
Yeah. I'm only playing around, Kurt.
Well, I had a question. It was, but I can relate it to the early church. After my question was something about the having to do with like you know how the magisterium is competent in teaching. It's authoritative. The teaching authority of the church is about what faith and morals regarding to Christianity, what Christians believe, dogmas of the church, morals. But it's not necessarily competent or authoritative what another religion believes or what, you know. So when you read the magisterial documents that affirm that Muslims believe in the same God, which I don't deny. I'm just warning about the authoritative level the magisterium holds in that. How is that different than the magisterium saying, you know, Platonists affirm X or Confucius said Y or Hindus affirm whatever? And what level of authority does that hold? And how are we to, you know,
right? That's a great question, because it's frankly at a low level of authority precisely for the reason that you identified, that the church is equipped by the Holy Spirit to explain what the true faith is. And so this comes up usually in the context of a heresy. When a heresy gets condemned, the people who are accused of holding the heresy will often say, oh, no, actually you misunderstood us. We didn't believe that. We believe this other slightly different thing that you haven't actually condemned. That kind of comes up a lot. And the reality is, you can't really we're not claiming that the infallibility of the church means that, like, we can read the hearts and minds of other people. We're not claiming that. So when the church, like, condemns a proposition, for instance, we're condemning the proposition as it's been taught. Now, maybe the person who taught it meant to say something else. Maybe they had a perfectly orthodox understanding and they just expressed themselves very badly. So one of the ways this comes up, I actually see on the screen that one of the upcoming calls is about Coptic Orthodoxy. And Coptic Orthodoxy is a great example of this. There's this really nuanced question of whether the Coptic Christians in the early centuries believed in monophysitism or what they called miaphysitism. In other words, they don't seem to just say Jesus has a human nature and a divine nature. And so because they wouldn't just say that, their critics are like, wait, you think Jesus just has one nature? And they would say he has one nature that is fully human and fully divine in an unmixed way. And it's like, are you saying the same thing as us in a more confusing way? Or are you denying that? And it's frankly continues to be a little bit unclear. But one of the things that Coptic Catholic dialogue has moved towards is we might be just talking past one another. So we can say very clearly, Jesus has a fully human nature. He has a fully divine nature. Those are not mixed. They are united. Now, if you have some other way of trying to say that, it's harder to tell whether you're agreeing with us or disagreeing. And so we can condemn people who say Jesus has one nature if they mean to deny the two natures of Christ. If they're using the word nature in a different way, maybe they're trying to say an orthodox thing just in a bad way. You see what I mean? So anytime we're talking about what other people teach or other people believe, whether we're saying we can agree on X or whether we're criticizing it, that is not going to be held to the same level of authority as when we're saying what Catholic teaching is. Because case in point, like, even if you're condemning a heretic for his heresies, maybe he had a conversion you didn't know about a week ago. And so we don't claim to know the inner life of the people that we're replying to, but we are saying, based on what you're saying, here's what we would say in terms of where we agree, where we disagree.
Okay. So
that makes sense?
Yes. So when Muslims say we believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the God of the Bible, then the Catholic Church would say, magisterium saying, if that is what you mean, then yes, you worship the same God, kind of?
Right. So, like, if somebody said that, but secretly they were an atheist, or their idea of God was, you know, we are not saying, we know for a fact that guy who says he worships the God of Abraham really does worship the God. Maybe he's an atheist who's just saying all of this stuff because he's not free to announce his atheism. We're not making a declaration on that at all. We're responding to the external evidence and saying where we agree and where we disagree.
Okay, gotcha.
All right.
And cool.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Kurt.
It was about the early church. I thank you for answering that question.
Oh, you bet.
Well, we're happy to have you. I remember you used to call before, but we haven't talked to you for a while, Kurt.
It has been a while. Well, yes, I called before, and I'm I'm glad to talk to you both again.
Me too.
And likewise.
If I was to relate it to the early church, and we have time, because it is an early church question, what did the early church say about other religions? Did they say anything about being saved by other religions that we see in the Second Vatican Council and after that would be?
They're not going to say that other religions save you, and I don't think the Second Vatican Council says other religions save you, but they can recognize where there are elements of Christianity in other religions. Now, that's not a very maybe politically correct way of saying that, but what we mean is we can recognize that God has revealed himself. So St. Paul in Romans 1 talks about the things that are knowable even by wicked pagans, that there are parts that God has revealed to everyone. So it'd be a mistake to imagine that revelation is limited to Christians. That is not the Christian belief. That is explicitly not what Christians believe. You can see, as I say in Romans, Romans 1 talks about this. Romans 1 through 3 talk about this a lot. Similarly, when St. Paul goes on to say, how can men be saved unless they believe? And how can they call on him unless they've heard him? But then he says, have they not heard? And then he quotes the Psalms that the voice of God has gone out to all the world. Now, that's talking about the voice of God in creation. And so it's saying there are elements of the faith that are knowable from reason, that you can know certain things about the existence of God, for example, that are at least going to lead you to what's called the natural version of religion. So that's all built into the New Testament itself. Early Christians like Justin Martyr build on this, and particularly on the idea of Jesus as the Logos. And so Logos means word, but it also means something close to reason. This is where words like logic comes from. And so he talks about, well, he'll just quote him. In First Apology, this is about 160. He says, we've been taught that Christ is the firstborn of God, and we have declared above that he is the word, the Logos, of whom every race of men were partakers. And those who lived reasonably are Christians, even though they have been thought atheists, as among the Greeks, Socrates and Heraclitus and men like them. So he's pointing to specific people within what we would consider Greek paganism and saying, no, like these people had reason to the fact that there was actually only one God and that this God was connected to this idea of logos. And we have to be able to recognize in that there's a prompting, a movement where, in his words, he can just call them Christians because they're living in accordance with the logos. Now, that is arguably beyond what I think the Second Vatican Council would be comfortable saying about people who aren't explicitly Christians. But it's the same basic idea of saying, it's not that God has given us everything and them nothing. It's that he's given us the fullness, and they may have elements of the truth that we can draw on, not as a good enough, therefore they don't need the gospel, but precisely as a kind of preparation for the gospel, that when we are proclaiming the gospel to people, we're proclaiming the gospel to people who God is already at work in, both at the level of conscience and at the level of reason, that they can know the world has a creator, they can know there's things like right and wrong, and they know that because God has revealed that to them. So those are things that Christians have been saying for the last two millennia, and I think that you can find plenty of things like that in the early days of Christianity as well.
And that, Kurt, is where we will leave it. Thank you very much for the call. I hope we hear from you again before too long, if you have the opportunity. The number is 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and we're talking about the early church today. If you have questions about the early church, 888-318-7884. Going to Arvin in Munster, Indiana, watching on YouTube. I don't know if that's how they pronounce it in Indiana. Is Munster correct, Arvin?
It's like, I think they call it YouTube. Everybody calls it YouTube.
Oh, I didn't hear Arvin's answer. Is that correct or wrong?
Sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Yeah, and welcome.
Munster. Hi, it's Munster, Indiana.
Like Herman, not like German. Okay, here we go. Joe, here's your question, Joe. Go ahead, Arvin.
So I am a big fan of your show. You guys are the reasons that I actually went, I'm currently in OCIA, and talking to you guys on the phone is actually getting me starstruck. So
it's just Joe Heschmeyer. No need to be starstruck. He puts on his pants two legs at a time like everyone else.
This isn't Jimmy Akin Day. We got the discount aisle.
It's not like it's Jimmy or Tim. It's just a regular guy. It's Joe.
So my question about the early church, I know you brush upon it with the other guy. Is regarding the Coptic Orthodox. I know that the Coptic and the early church split during like the 450s after the Council of Chalcedon, and it's regarding Jesus's natures. Can you like elaborate on that? And like, are we trying to get back in unity with them too, or like they're just not there?
Can you wait a second, Arvin?
I will answer that after this brief commercial break.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Arvin. Right back. Talking about the early church, there's three lines open right now. So if you want to talk to Joe Heschmeyer, no need to be starstruck. Just dial 888-318-7884.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What is the Catholic Church? Everybody seems to have an opinion, but the church never quite fits into the boxes people try to make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
On Thursday's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, our topic will be, who do you know that really deserves to be blessed by God? And now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Arvin on the line in Munster, Indiana, with a question about the Coptic churches, Joe, and whether is anything happening there, or are we just resigned to the fact that we are divided from the Coptic churches?
Yeah. So, without getting super in the weeds, some of this has to do with how to interpret certain passages of Saint Cyril of Alexandria. That's where this kind of controversy in the 400s comes up. But at the heart of it is, as I said before, we want to affirm that Jesus is fully God and fully man, but not in some kind of blended way where he's, you know, 50%, 50%. It's 100% and 100%, and his two natures are united in one person, but in an unblended way. Now, that is hard for people to get their minds around. You know, we would say something like, if you've got a blue square, it's fully blue, it's fully a square, it's not half and half. It's not half blue and half square. It's entirely one and entirely the other, because divinity and humanity are so unlike that God can be both of those without contradiction. That's a lot of what's being defended at Chalcedon. And either as a result of a theological disagreement or a certain amount of kind of confusion, there is this schism that happens in Egypt. And with the Patriarch of Alexandria being deposed and declaring that he won't accept Chalcedon, and it creates what we call Coptic Orthodoxy, or this is sometimes part of what's called Oriental Orthodoxy. This is confusing because Oriental and Eastern mean the same thing, but the Oriental Orthodox and the Eastern Orthodox are not the same. In terms of current things, if you just look at the last, say, since 1979, beginning with John Paul II, we've been really pushing in a renewed way for greater unity with the Copts. This is not entirely new. The Council of Florence, the Coptic delegates had announced that they were ready to acknowledge the leadership of the Pope and were ready to enter full union with the Catholic Church. This didn't really play out on the ground. There's been a renewed push in the last several decades. In 1979, there's a document called Principles for Guiding the Search for Unity Between the Catholic Church and the Coptic Orthodox Church, and the Protocol Joint to the Principles. Boring name, but the critical thing there is both sides of the conversation realize we need full unity. We're not just striving for, hey, look, we agree on a lot of stuff. Isn't that great? We would actually like to be one church because both sides have apostolic succession. We recognize the other as apostolic churches, but we believe that all of the churches with apostolic succession should be united. And the document is very clear. Once unity is achieved, the richness of the various Christian traditions existing in Egypt would find clear and legitimate expression for the enrichment of all within the one Coptic church under the leadership of the Pope of Alexandria and Patriarch of the See of St. Mark. In other words, we would want to preserve the distinctive elements of Coptic Orthodoxy within Coptic Catholicism. And you can see, you know, this is the pattern with Eastern rites. But significantly, like, both sides agreed to this, that we seem like we are ultimately meant to be headed on this journey where the Copts are reunited with the Catholic Church, but as a legitimate expression, you know, as one, what's sometimes called sui juris church, or one, you know, maybe a liturgical rite and tradition within the Catholic Church. I mean, their patriarch would be the so-called Pope of Alexandria. They use the term for their head as well. Ultimately under the authority of Pope Leo or his successors. Does that make sense?
Yes.
All right, Arvin, a satisfied customer. Thanks very much. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, just one line open right now. It's, you can ask him anything you want about the early church. He wrote a book called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. 888-318-7884 is the number. One of the great things about Joe, and there's many great things about Joe, but one of them is, you can ride on a boat with him down the or up the Rhine, up the Rhine River, starting on May 3rd, going to May 14th, starting in Amsterdam and ending in Basel. And it's the whole boat, the whole ship, the whole thing.
Is Joe Heschmeyer.
Is not Joe Heschmeyer, no. it's a Catholic Answers, folks. Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, will be there too. Hi, Chris.
How are you, Cy? How are you, Joe?
Super good.
Good.
Super good.
Good.
Doing all right, yeah.
Only a few cabins left, Cy, and we want to fill them up.
Yeah, and Jen told me there's an amazing...
Yeah, it's even more amazing than that one you've got there.
Oh, you got a better one?
I have it here.
Oh, well, let's do the better one. Forget this one, then.
Yeah, so she described to me that there there are a few rooms left on the AA deck.
Really?
Yes.
All right.
And then also on, like, the BA deck or something like that.
All right.
I don't know what this means. These are decks.
BA was a guy in the
Bachelor of Arts. You have to have a Bachelor of Arts to stay in one of these rooms.
No, I was thinking of the guy in I can't think of it.
All right, here's the gist. This is the gist. So I think the AA rooms are a little bit better than the BA rooms. They're all lovely. This is AMA. It's the cruise line AMA. It's the best of the river cruise lines. How can I describe this? You can get a bottle of wine from the Modesto Valley. And technically, it's a bottle of wine. Or you can get one from Sonoma or Napa.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you can ride on another line that I won't name, or you can ride on AMA.
The one that PBS uses is the one you're not naming?
Well, I'm not. So think of it as the Sonoma or the Napa version.
Uh-huh.
They're really lovely boats. We used them once before when we did the Danube. They're absolutely lovely. So every room is delightful. But... $600 off per person, so that's $1,200 savings.
No way.
If you book the AA rooms or the next level down, $500 off a person, that's $1,000 for the couple. So massive savings on these remaining rooms. And I just found out, by the way, we had a cancellation in one of the even lower rooms. So there's a
no, I'm still coming.
Was,
so that those of you who went on and said, oh, none of the less expensive rooms are available, they, I think there are one or two, but there are just a few left on the entire boat, and we're clearing them out. We want to clear them out.
So where do you go? You go to CatholicCruise.com?
Yeah.
CatholicCruise.com. Or, and how do you get the $600 off?
Send an, send an email. What's Jen's email? What's her address?
I don't know if I'm...
Give out Jen's address on the air.
I don't actually know it.
Give out her
email address, her home address.
Give her... Give out her cell phone number.
All right.
No, it's, what is it? Is it cruise@catholic.com or Jennifer? Or
well,
Jennifer?
I'm sure that.
How about this?
Go to catholiccruise.com and you will find it there.
Yeah. Or if you can't remember any of that, send an email to radio@catholic.com.
Very good.
And just say, put in the subject line, I really want to go on this cruise.
All right.
You know what? I can attest. I would just went on our internal Outlook. And I can send an email to something called cruise@catholic.com. I don't know who will get it, if anyone.
It goes to Jen.
Jen,
but you never know.
Yeah.
Jen will get it.
So if you want a massive discount, send her a note. And then what she'll do is say, because her office is right next to mine. And she'll say, Chris, this person wants a massive discount. How much of a discount can we give them? And then I'll say, Jen, are they nice people? And she'll say, of course they are. And I'll say, well, give them this deal.
Wow. So you can get the nice people discount. We don't even know what that is.
Yeah. Well, you have to be. We have a way to vet you, right? We see
you
if you've said
pass Jen's test.
Yeah,
we'll
see if you said something mean on Twitter or X, whatever.
Is that what we're going to do? We're going to do a social media search.
Yes, I know. But right. Look, quite
this
seriously,
this is not going to go well.
My friends, the entire boat is Catholic Answers. Father Sebastian Walsh of the Norbertines is our chaplain. We're going to have some beautiful masses on shore in some of the most magnificent churches of the Catholic Rhine Valley. We're going to see the Strasbourg Cathedral. We're going to see the Cologne Cathedral, which is where the three kings are. It's true.
Right. Yes. And
Joe's going to give a talk on the three kings. Is that not true, Joe?
That is true.
I think that's right.
I'm doing a talk.
You're
It'll be prepared the
doing...
day before, but it's going to be great.
Well, this actually is true because Joe packs the day before or the day of. Did you know that?
Joe, I don't even know that he is called packing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just throws it in a hefty bag and drags it onto the airplane with
him. So there'll be like packing tips from Joe, European packing trips from Joe Heschmeyer also. I'm going to do a little talk on Charlemagne because when we think about this Rhine River Valley and the Catholic Rhineland and the Germans, who are the people who really bring Christianity into action, right? They're the people who make Christendom. I know they're using Roman ideas and revelation to the Jews and Greek thought and these sorts of things. But it's the Germans who put it into action. The central figure is Charlemagne. So we're gonna go to Trier. We're going to go to Aachen. We're going to see where he worked. He worked everywhere. So we'll have a little talk. What are you talking about, Cy?
Hildegard of Bingen. Yeah. I can't wait to talk about her because I think there's a vast misunderstanding of women in the Middle Ages or women in Christendom. In
I
the
think there's still, Christendom. Isn't there still something of a misunderstanding of women in our own age?
Well, I know I have slipped into some misunderstandings with at least one pretty regularly. But, I mean, one of the greatest people that ever lived, Hildegard of Bingen.
Doctoress of the Church.
Yeah.
A
scientist, a theologian, philosopher.
Beer maker.
Abbess. So I'll get to talk about Hildegard of Bingen.
Before Charlemagne is Boniface, apostle to the Slavs. Apostle to the Germans. Right. And so I'll be talking about Boniface. And I know Father Sebastian Walsh because it'll be the month of May. He's going to have a lot of Marian talks.
A whole bunch of Marian stuff. Come with us. Yeah, just go to CatholicCruise.com, find out all about it, and then send an email asking for the nice people discount.
Deals on these final rooms, folks.
Cruise@catholic.com. Cruise@catholic.com.
What's your second talk, Joe?
He didn't even know what his first talk
was. Wait, Joe, you're giving a talk on the three kings, but that's one talk.
I've got these written down. I have not written.
We had a meeting. We wrote them down. He's going to refer to the notes at some point.
It's going to be good. Oh, wait a minute.
Exactly.
Okay.
If you think I write my talks this many months ahead, I've got to.
Having heard your talk, Joe, I don't have that impression at all.
Exactly.
Ooh, I was channeling Cy Kellett there.
Oh, man.
So wait a minute.
Channeling Cy Kellett is how I describe being mean as well.
Couple more things. We're going to have a live episode, a live incarnate episode of the Flannel Panel.
We are, yes.
And I'm going to say one more thing. When you go on, especially when you go on one of the ocean liners for cruises, you pay to come on there, and then they nickel-dime you on if you get an alcoholic drink or if you book a shore excursion or any number of things. This cruise is entirely inclusive. You pay to come on the boat, and then all your drinks, all your food, all your shore excursions. And we've designed these shore excursions to undergird, to reinforce, what's the verb I'm looking for, Sai? So that they harmonize with the talks that we're giving. So it's going to be a coherent cruise.
Yeah, that's the word. Yeah. I like it. You scare me when you say, what's the word? I'm like, oh, man, I'm a terrible thesaurus. I can't think of things.
We've cohered the talks.
It will all cohere.
Yeah.
And it'll be fun. We have a great time,
it's
too.
It's going to be.
Because the people who come are wonderful people. CatholicCruise.com or just send an email to cruise@catholic.com. cruise@catholic.com.
And ask for the nice people discount.
And do. Unless you're not a nice person.
Right.
Don't. I can't get that discount, but we'd love to see you there.
God bless you, gentlemen.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris.
You know what? I got to say thanks to Darren Sutton on YouTube. When Chris said BA, I was like, that's from that TV show. It was the A-Team. B.A. Baracus was the name
Mr. T's character.
For Mr. T, yeah. So
it's confusing because he is already known by a letter. And
Chris said, I love it when a plan comes together, and then he left. all right, let's go to Scotland. You want to go to Scotland?
Yeah.
Not the real Scotland, but the Scotland. I mean, it is the real Scotland, but we're not going there. We're going by phone. Thomas in Scotland, welcome.
G'day there. How's it?
It's going very well. Is it midnight there in Scotland?
Almost. It's about 12:45 now.
Well, thank you for staying up. You're very welcome here. You got a question for Joe?
Yeah, so my question is to do with usury and investing. I know this is a bit off the topic of tonight, but
you called from Scotland. It's a free for all if you call from Scotland.
Yeah.
So ask whatever you want.
Appreciate it. So what I'm curious about is what sort of the church is teaching on, what's the moral difference between like usury and investing, because it seems like you're making money to make money, but then assuming that your answer is once clarified that investing, if done morally, is acceptable, my question would then be, what is morally acceptable investing, and how do you avoid idolizing money before God?
Yeah, this is a very good question, and this is a question that's been
It is a bit all over the place. I do apologize.
No, it's a good question, and I believe it was Hilaire Belloc who has an interesting thing on the history of usury, because it's not just that our understanding of usury has been debated over the centuries, but even our understanding of money. Mm-hmm. So if you think about like currency right now, whether we're talking about, you know, the dollar or the pound or the euro or whatever, it's not tied to, it's not backed by anything real. Is so-called fiat currency.
Okay.
Whereas in the old days, you know, it was pegged to like gold or something. So it's actually very important as we're talking about things like interest and usury, that we also think about things like inflation and the really complicated difference between what money is now and what money was before. And maybe that sounds like completely abstract, but our whole concept of money has actually changed in more profound ways than I think people realize. And so the line between interest and usury is a somewhat blurry one. William Blackstone, his Commentaries on the Laws of England, makes this point. He says, when money is lent on a contract to receive not only the principal sum again, but also an increase by way of compensation for the use, the increase is called interest by those who think it lawful, and usury by those who do not. So his argument was like, if you're okay with it, it's interest. If you're not, it's usury. That's obviously too vague of a definition. The Fifth Lateran Council, let me add one other thing. When people throughout the centuries use the term usury, it's not clear they always have the exact same concept in mind. Like, some people are against any interest at all on money. And one of the problems with that in applying it to the modern context is with inflation, that would mean that you would lose money on every loan. Or you could have, you can have interest, but it has to be tacked to inflation, so you're getting basically the equivalent back. And then some people are going to say, no, you should be allowed a certain rate of interest over the rate of inflation to correspond to the risk that you as a lender are taking, namely the risk of default. that you shouldn't be, you know, exploiting the poor. But if you're giving out money and expecting it to be returned, but you know a certain percentage of people you're loaning money to won't be able to pay it back, the only way you can continue to do that is if your risk is compensated somehow. And so the closest we get to an early definition of usury that I know of is in 1515 at the Fifth Lateran Council, where it says, for that is the real meaning of usury, when from its use, a thing which produces nothing is applied to the acquiring of gain and profit without any work, any expense, or any risk. In other words, you shouldn't be profiting off doing no work, incurring no expense, and incurring no risk. And so if there's a system where, frankly, I think you could make this argument that we see widespread usury when you have things like banks that can't fail, that they're backed up by the government, that there's no real risk being taken there, then it looks like they're just making money off the fact they have money. And that's the kind of thing that we say is usury. We reject that, and we are against that. The mere fact that you are loaning something and there's a certain interest rate at a reasonable level is allowable because you are taking a risk. And we want to make sure that there's enough, I don't want to say enough interest because that's confusing, enough of an incentive for you to want to loan money. But we also don't want that to become a way of the rich predating upon the poor. So it is a contentious and tricky issue that I think needs more development, quite frankly. Because we should have a clearer standard of when something becomes loan sharking or usurious and when it's legitimate interest based on the fact that you're incurring a certain level of risk. Does that make sense, Thomas?
I'm really hoping you guys can hear me because I cut out.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can hear you now.
Oh, fantastic. You know, I was frantically ringing back is like, oh, please, 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 just go straight through.
Oh,
I caught the second half of that, and I'll happily check out the first half after this. So,
wonderful. Yeah, well, if you have further questions, please call back.
Yeah, I'll give you guys another call.
And for a small fee, we can loan you more answers. If you're looking for more answers, we're happy to loan them to you. For
Scotesian questions, Catholic answers.
Appreciate it.
Thomas, thanks for staying up late and talking with us. Jen. Yep. I'm sorry. I think we're talking past. We got a little bit of a delay in the line, so I'll just say thanks, Thomas. And on I go. No, I got to take a quick break. I didn't take the break. I beg your pardon. We'll be right back with more Ask Joe Anything about the early church on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What have you always wanted to know about the Vatican? Well, I'm your Vatican Insider, and I answer that question when I bring you the news about the Pope, Vatican City, and I share insights and stories from a broad spectrum of church ministries.
Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis, Saturday night, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Joe Heschmeyer, our guest this hour and next, and you can ask him anything you like about the early church. Oh, the early church, the first century, the century that Jesus and the apostles lived in, the second century, those who knew the apostles, and the third century. You know, early church probably goes up to, I don't know, the 700s or something. I don't. Let's go until the birth of Muhammad. We'll say all that's. If you got a question about the early church, you can ask Joe. When he wrote his book, The Early Church is the Catholic Church, he focused on the first 200 years, however, because there's a lot of There's a lot of misconception that we really don't know anything about the earliest part of the church. So it's only after Constantine that this. The early church was the Catholic Church, and we got. Is it fair to say we have the receipts, Joe?
I think that's fair to say.
All right.
I mean, we have bishop lists. We have those kind of things. That's really close to a receipt.
Janelle in Florida is watching on YouTube. Welcome, Janelle. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. I'd just like to say thank you because a few weeks ago I called and asked Mr. Joe Heschmeyer a question, and you guys sent me The Early Church was the Catholic Church.
Oh.
I have a question about that book. I finished it.
Yeah.
Is it about the typos? Because we can't do anything about that now. I mean, all the misspelled words and stuff. Is that
I didn't notice any.
Oh, okay, good. All right. Good. Thank you, Janelle.
My question is about very early in the book. You say that the early church was theologically conservative and that, quote, they held fast to the beliefs that were handed on to them and opposed new doctrines. So how would that apply to other, like, doctrinal developments such as, like, icon veneration or much later, like, Marian consecration and those kinds of, like, pious practices? Would the church fathers have been opposed to that? And should we be practicing those kinds of things if we don't know that they would have supported them?
Okay, this is a great question. So I want to unpack a couple things on the particulars of your examples, because when we talk about practices as opposed to beliefs or like dogmas, the fact that a new practice might emerge, you could have a new prayer or a new method of praying or something like this. There could be new prayers in the Mass itself. That's not contrary to this theological conservatism, this theological traditionalism, right? Like, you can believe the same thing and still pray a different prayer tomorrow than you prayed yesterday. That makes sense? This is the difference between a discipline and a dogma in some way. And so certainly in terms of something like, you know, we don't know what early prayers to Mary look like. There's this ongoing dispute about, we have a very old scrap of what's called the Subtuum Presidium. There's an old scrap of papyrus that has an early prayer to Mary, and we don't know exactly how early it is. The original dating suggested it could be as early as like the 200s. So we don't have to say these are exactly the prayers people would have said in, you know, the 200s. That's not something we're claiming, and it's not a standard any Christian lives by. Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, nobody is doing that. Nobody's trying to do that. We want to make sure we have the same faith as the early Christians. And so St. Vincent of Lorraine in, what is that, the 6th century, gives a really helpful guide. He says, there's a couple ways we can know this. And this is in a book called The Commentorium. This is book 2. He says we can fortify our belief in two ways. First, by the authority of the divine law, and then by the tradition of the Catholic Church. And then he wants to lay out principles by which we can know. This is what's sometimes called the Vincentian canon. Well, how do we know what, you know, the traditional faith is? He's already told us one way by what the Catholic Church teaches. But he suggests a threefold method as well, called universality, antiquity, and consent. So, and he defines what he means by each of those. He says, by universality, we confess that one faith to be true, which the whole church throughout the world confesses. By antiquity, we in no ways depart from those interpretations, which it is manifest were publicly held by our holy ancestors and fathers. And consent, in consent, we look to what was held by at least almost all the priests and doctors of old. But he's very clear. He then asks, is there to be no development or no progress in Christ's church? He says, certainly all possible progress on condition, he says, that it be real progress, not alteration of the faith. So a puppy can become a dog. A puppy can't become a cat. There can be legitimate development of doctrine while still holding to the one faith.
Janelle, you probably hear the music, which means we are right up against the break. We've got to take this break, and then we will come back. There are two lines open for those who have questions about the early church for Joe Heschmeyer. 888-318-7884 is the number. Let's send Janelle Pope Peter, since we sent her that other book and we kind of cut her off. Right back with more Joe Heschmeyer, Catholic Answers Live.